Jan Moriarty is my guest this week. My name is Chris DC. Now, Jan is Student Success Manager at the University of Kent. It's a wonderful project designed to change people's lives, to support students to achieve better degrees. Now, we learn how Jan became involved in the project, how her initial concern that it was not going to be possible to solve EDI issues in just 2 years were balanced by the consideration that morally it was something that just had to be done. It reveals who is flourishing, who is not. For example, a black student is more likely to come out with a worse degree than their white peers. It's about holding a mirror up to the institution and changing our behaviours and changing mindsets. Now, crucial to Jan's work is the extent to which we have to take people with us, and that those with white privilege have to use their white privilege as a force for change. Now, we learn that Jan did a joint honours degree in sociology and dance back in the 80s at Roehampton. Her father was a trades union rep. Her mother had quite different political sensibilities. Jan reflects on how education, when she was growing up, wasn't really about questioning. She was brought up in a Northern Roman Catholic family with Irish heritage, where religion was pretty much one-dimensional. Now, Jan talks about the reinvention of herself, which can entail getting rid of things from her past. And she reflects on how we present ourselves to the world in a way that we want others to see us. Jan talks about being in the LGBT community and the constant need to negotiate one's sexuality in relation to the world. She grew up straight in a straight world where questioning wasn't something that one did. Only when she went to university was she able to meet other people in other environments. She met her wife first in 1985, but it was many more years before they got together. Now, Jan discusses how anti-LGBT discrimination was everywhere back in the 80s, how it was a dangerous time to be gay. She talks about her thoughts on the Thatcher government. Jan understands why some young people lose contact with their families due to their sexual orientation. And Jan talks about the importance for straight people to support minoritised groups. We move on towards the end of the interview to talk about Brexit and the way that it has fostered othering. The same applies to racism in the context of the Euro 2020 final. We talk about people's fears of gay people. We find out whether Jan looks backwards or forwards, and why she thinks that the present is all that we have. It was an immense privilege for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews to meet Jan Moriarty from the University of Kent. My name is Chris DC. Well, it's an absolute pleasure this week to have Jan Moriarty. And Jan, we were saying, I've known you for years. I think it must have been about 5 or 6 years ago when you were perhaps in architecture.
Yes, possibly so. I started in architecture in 2013 and then moved across the student success team in 2015. And I think you've been involved with student success all the way through that, if possibly not before.
Yeah, and I feel a bit of a fraud sometimes because I'm conscious that when it comes to data, you know, that's not my forte. So sometimes I have meetings with you and I'm thinking, ooh, you know, in terms of actually dissecting it all and doing all the quantitative work. But I mean, that actually is one of the real awakening experiences in my time at Kent, to suddenly realise that the students that you're teaching, they're sitting in front of you, but you're overlooking something really important about their progression. It's almost like, you know, there's something we can do about it, and there's a trend. And so how did you get involved in the Student Success Project?
Well, to be honest, when I was in architecture, my line manager at the time bounced into the office and said, there's going to be this pilot. And she did sign up for all the pilots, which was great. But and it's equality, diversity, inclusivity. Jan, I want you to lead it on professional services side, and there'll be an academic leading on academic side. And I remember my heart sank, really, because I think my first thought was, oh God, you know, it's so hard to solve equality, diversity, inclusivity. It's almost impossible. Please don't make me do this. It's not something you can just turn around in 2 years. And it was a 2-year pilot. But similarly, there's also a sort of strong strand of social justice in me that when I realised that it wasn't just sort of equality in its broadest sense and just, you know, one of those things that nobody really understands, it was actually based on data that was demonstrating that some of our students here were not being afforded the same chances as some other groups. And we say non-traditional students, but actually what we're really talking about is students according to their socioeconomic status or their ethnicity and or their age. And in some respects, their disabilities or non-disabled status. I think once I grasped that concept, it just felt like morally we have to do something about this. And I think that's probably the message that we all carry with us and we hope that people will respond to, that once people hear that the same chances are not being afforded to, for example, black students, UK home-based black students, as their white peers, then we hope that the moral case will speak for itself. It doesn't always, but we hope that that's the message that we're taking out with it. Well, we know that's the message we're taking out with us. We hope that's the thing that will hit home.
Yeah, because in my case, what I was finding is that I was looking at the data and I was then thinking about particular students in my class, and 100% it applied in each case, that the students who were struggling were the ones who we found were from, you know, black, Asian backgrounds, and in some cases were, this was the interesting thread I found, in some cases were not always engaging to the same extent, you know, with presentations or in some cases just not passing to the, you know, on the same way. And so when it came to resits in the summer and so on, then, you know, there was a trend, and then it was a case of, okay, well, what do we do about that? Do we just, you know, shrug our shoulders and think everyone's got the same chances, or do we actually say no? And then what the data showed is that even those students who were coming here, even if they had good A-level results, they were still performing worse by the end of their 3 or 4 year degree as their white counterparts. And in that sense, it was such an eye-opening experience. And of course, once you then see that, then there's no looking back. And I, all I can do is hope that we've really supported lots of students, and the students, you know, or the students of tomorrow are going to be more likely to go to university because they know that we have these structures in place.
I hope so. I think that the understanding that there is an inequity built into higher education, it's not just here at Kent, it's everywhere. I think students are aware of that now. You know, they're much more savvy now than when I went to university. And I think that it's really important that we are transparent about that. And of course, what the data, and, you know, I must say that, you know, so that I'm not a fraud, you know, the data wasn't unearthed by me. It was unearthed by somebody, by Sharon Smith, who was in Partnership Development Office at the time. And had just sort of taken this massive data exercise and unearthed, you know, she was asking the right questions of the data, questions that nobody in HE had really asked before. And I think it is like Pandora's box. Once you open that particular box, there isn't anything you can do to get everything back in there. And you shouldn't want to, but I think that there is a tendency for people, it's very difficult, it's very challenging for, you know, academics who may have been teaching for very many years and have seen students flourish in that format of their teaching, to then have, you know, these sort of student success upstarts bounce into their office and say, oh yes, but actually when you look at who is flourishing as opposed to who is not, there's a problem and we need to address that. And I think that it's relatively, at the beginning in 2015 when we were talking to academic teams about supporting students and putting in additional activities for students to help support their outcomes, it was an easier win than it is today, when our primary message is, look, something happens to students when they come here, because our data tells us that when, once you take out all of that noise and you look at the same age students with the same socioeconomic background, the same A levels, with the same grades, a black student is still more likely to come out with a worse degree outcome than their white peer. It's not a blanket. It's not a law. But the data trends tell us that that happens. And actually, our primary purpose, I think, is to hold a mirror up to the institution to say it is not. We need to stop trying to fit round students into square institutional holes. We need to look at the institution and think about our processes, our procedures, our teaching, the very fabric upon which higher education institutions are built. And that's a massive concept to take to your university.
Yeah, well, it is, because I just think about what I was taught when I was an undergraduate, and in some cases, I mean, I've been here for 17 years, but, you know, in some cases, you know, I teach many of the same modules that I was teaching 17 years ago, but I realise now, in terms of decolonising the curriculum, you suddenly realise, and it was literally just, I think, 2 years ago, that that one of my modules was subject, I put it forward, you know, as a to see exactly how the data on the reading list for that module played out. And it, you know, it was like 90% white European or North American male authors, and it was just, and I thought, well, I'm teaching the same sort of stuff that, you know, I was teaching 10, 20, and maybe I was taught myself 30 years ago. And then you think, oh yeah. And then, of course, when you reflect on it, you realise that what you're doing is very narrow. And we had a colleague at one point who was from the Global South, from Brazil, and she was only here for a short period, but she was bringing some wonderful diversity into the programme. When she left, then, you know, I was very conscious that actually we can't just carry on doing the same thing as we did before. But it is a kind of crisis of faith, because you suddenly realise that there's something you're not aware of doing something, or you're not aware of not doing something, and then you suddenly realise that you have to almost like go back, and you can see that the problem has always been there. It's been implicit, or it hasn't been acknowledged. And I think that is an interesting awakening. But have you found over the last few years that there has been a real sort of momentum and an acceptance at the university that this has to happen?
I think we're getting there. And I think with any sort of massive institutional change, one of the things for me, it's about changing behaviours, and that then changes mindset. And you with the best will in the world, you know, the Vice Chancellor could put out 100 missives and say, you're all just going to do this because I say so. And that won't change the way that people think and behave. And you're trying to address people's really ingrained values systems. And that's pretty challenging. I think we're moving in the right direction, but there's a lot of work to do, and it's time consuming, but there's a lot of work to do with individuals. We need to take people with us, but that entails giving them the confidence to unearth some of their own stuff. And I'm always very struck by, you know, this can't be the work of people of colour, because it's traumatising and it's emotionally stressful for black, Asian, minority ethnic folk to be constantly trying to challenge a predominantly white institution. You know, this is the work of the white privileged. We know we have to accept, first of all, that we have that white privilege, and then ask, you know, what do we do with it? How do we use that as a force for change, in order to provide those opportunities that we are not providing, or are sort of looking the other way slightly because we're worried that if we actually look at them, to be fair, many people just, how do you know where to begin? How do you know how to start? It's a massive, massive undertaking. And I think what we're in the business of is making that manageable and taking projects to jobbing academic teams and to jobbing professional service teams and saying, look, here's something that we can do. It's, you know, diversity mark, diversifying reading lists. It's not the beginning and end of inclusive curriculum, decolonising curriculum. It's just a little tiny step on the way, but it's something that's manageable, and it's hopefully non-threatening, although not everybody accepts that it's non-threatening, and that we can use to help people sort of start on that journey. And it is something that demands a lot of self-reflection and challenges people's values, and I that's always going to be a difficult thing.
Yeah. And do you reflect back on your own time at university and think, you know, how different through the lens, and that's the great thing about hindsight, of course, hindsight gives you the opportunity to see things in a completely different light, but are you aware of just how differently things are configured now compared to, you know, 3 decades ago or whatever it might be?
Really, I really am. I think, you know, one of the things about when I went to university, everybody did joint honours at the... I was at Roehampton. Oh. And everybody did joint honours. And I had failed my first lot of A-levels. So I applied to Bradford College of FE to take some brand new A-levels, but to do them in a year. So I did psychology, which was done in a year, and sociology, which was done in 2 years, but they allowed me to compress them into a year. And I chose those because those weren't A-levels that were on offer in my secondary school. And they were just new and exciting, and I just thought, I'll try some of those. And found that I did okay, but also really enjoyed them. And particularly sociology for me, I think switched on... Well, I won't say switched on my political brain, because my parents were... My dad was a staunch trade union. He was a trade union rep. And my mum was a bit of a Tory back in the day. So conversations, political conversations across the dinner table were always quite rife. So it didn't switch on my political brain, but I think it helped me to make sense of a really complex world and gave me an understanding of things that it just opened so many different areas of the world to me that I'd never really considered before. That whole issue of class, which incidentally my mother didn't believe in, and we were very working class family. For me, it started to make sense. So that's what I decided to study at university as my part joint honours, and the other side was dance, because it was the only thing I was good at, really.
See, that sounds like an amazing and perfect joint honours combination, because we've lost a lot of our joint honours programmes, but we had every year, we'd always have students here doing religious studies and drama, and not many, because we're a very small department, but one or two a year, and they always seem to be the ones who got, you know, the best grades. We'd often have, you know, first class degree in religious studies and drama. And I'd often say, you know, oh, what made you come to Kent? And they'd say, oh, because we wanted to do this combination. And it's one of perhaps only two places, maybe the only one in the whole country that offered it. So how did you... I'm guessing that you were able to find synergies that maybe your tutors may not have done, because you were the person who was like bringing these different disciplines together.
Well, that makes me sound like I was really switched on, and I'm not really sure that I was. I think I just... My degree is a little bit of a blur in many senses, because I came from a background where you had so much respect for the knowledge that you know, your teacher said something was this is a thing, okay, that's a thing. An education back then wasn't one of questioning, and you know, we sat in rows and we sat quietly and we were preached at. That's not criticism, it's just the way things were, and you absorbed what you were taught. You know, this is pre-league table days, so we didn't have to be hothoused in quite the same way that children do now. So I think that I carried on that same approach when I went to university, that I literally just especially with sociology, I literally just absorbed all of this. I felt so green and such a beginner, because it was all just new ideas to me. You know, just thinking about communism and socialism and social justice was not something that I hadn't been brought up with it, and I didn't. It was like a brand new world. So I'd love to say that I had, you know, brought together these two worlds. I did a module in anthropology and realised that dance and sociology, or dance and anthropology, were linked, because dance was such a key element of human life as it developed. And I think that then began to make sense to me about, you know, actually, this thing that I love, in terms of it, of dance, this is something that is common to all communities all over the world, in the same way that music is. And for me, that kind of joined up the two things in my head. I can't say that I made any sort of, you know, brought any brilliant insights to the course.
Yeah, but maybe you can do that now in retrospect. But it's interesting because I did religion. Well, I did theology at university. But interestingly, we didn't have those sort of conversations at home. And I wonder if on some level, that was why I wanted to study it. It was more that I was going into something which fascinated me, but it wasn't something that I went into with a sort of a set of values or assumptions. It was more that I felt unprepared or inadequate, because, you know, in a way you can't get away from religion, but it's also something that's very polarizing. You know, as I always find at the supermarket sometimes, people say, "What do you teach?" And you suddenly think, oh, gulp, you know, and you know that it's a subject that isn't met with indifference. People don't normally say, "What is that?" They normally then, you know, start telling you about some issue or difficulty or challenge that or part of their life story. But it is interesting in retrospect, you know, sometimes why we undertake particular paths, because we want to understand something that's either, in your case, in terms of issues around class or class that wasn't discussed. But it's interesting sometimes that you want to find your own way through this, your own voice, rather than, you know, whereas around you there might be competing voices that just don't quite fit for you, and you want to find a way of assembling them.
Well, and it's interesting what you're saying about theology, because I loved religious studies at school, and I think that's partly because I was brought up in a Northern Catholic family, Irish heritage family, and Catholicism was just not questioned, it was just there in our lives. I knew that my mother had converted to Catholicism because she had to be able to marry my father back in the day. But religion was very one-dimensional, I think, in our family. And I think studying religious studies at school, and I took one of my O-levels GCSEs, for the younger listeners in the audience, I think that again, that probably started that process of broadening the world out for me, because suddenly we were hearing about Islam and about Buddhism and about the Jewish communities, and, you know, and all of these different, and suddenly there were lives that were very different to mine, and similar in some ways, but just with a different sort of theological head on top of them. But I think that probably, I remember sitting in those classes and really absorbing that, all of that information, those different worlds, I think, is probably the best way to put it. So perhaps actually it wasn't sociology that started that process. Perhaps it was actually the religious studies that broadened the world out for me.
No, it's funny you say that, because in my case, I think that having gone to university to study theology, I stopped going to church, because I suddenly realised that I had more freedom and flexibility in terms of the study. So I found my own way through these issues, whereas I was often going to an Anglican church in Cardiff, and suddenly, you know, I was one of the youngest people there. And then I was conscious that there are some subjects like the ordination of women priests. I remember having that conversation with the female deacon that we had at the church. It was like there was a no-go area. And it's just really interesting how sometimes we're exposed to all sorts of issues and tensions and debates and challenges, but it's because you don't feel that it's socially acceptable in some context to raise them, that you have to find your own way through that. And academic study can be so liberating. You know, I went to university, you know, feeling I knew very little about my subject. And then, well, because what do you then do? You say, OK, well, I'll go to the library, and you take all the books off the shelf, and suddenly, you know, you've got an essay to be written in a week or two. And suddenly you think, oh, I feel like a bit of a mini expert. Not, you know, just in the sense that you knew. I remember in my case, it was the disestablishment of the church in Wales. Admittedly, I've forgotten it all now. But I remember suddenly thinking, oh, I knew nothing about this 2 weeks ago. And suddenly now I feel that I know the different arguments. And it's just really quite funny. And you suddenly think, oh, you know, so somebody asks me, I've written this essay, I've got 3,000 words. And, you know, and to this day, I've still got all those essays that I wrote all those years ago and all my notes. I kind of feel, yeah. Did you not do that?
No. I'm a real, you know, I just throw things. I've moved around a lot.
Yeah.
And I will just throw things away. It is part of, I think, that reinvention of myself that I feel compelled to do, is to sort of just let that stuff, not just let it go, but actually get rid of it. I've held on to very, very little from my past. And I like you, I keep a diary, intermittently, it has to be said. But, you know, there's several volumes of that over the years. And then there have been, you know, many years when it's just sort of languished. And I do look back at that. And I think that is most commonly about what I will do is I'll look back at, you know, how was I feeling this time last year? So what I've realised about myself is that life is really about your emotional connection and your emotional navigation of the world. So I will often go back to sort of the year before and the year before that and remind myself of things that were happening. And some of it's completely cringeworthy. And I wouldn't want anybody else in the world to ever see. So if I ever get noticed that I'm about to shuffle off this mortal coil, I think I'll have a massive bonfire in the garden.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because is it the things that happened that were cringeworthy, or your take on them, your interpretation of them, your reading of them at the time?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think it is some of the things that happened. It's some of the decisions that I made and some of my processing of that just reminds me of whether I made a good decision or I didn't. I mean, I don't really believe in bad decisions. I just believe that you make a decision. Yeah. If you don't agree with yourself and you think, oh, that was a bit rubbish, then just make another decision and move on. You know, don't go around sort of thinking, oh, God, I regret that so much, and turn your, you know, make it sort of affect your life. But I think we all present ourselves to the world, don't we, in the way that we want others to see us. And I don't think that I would ever just sort of, you know, hand out my diary to even to my other half and say, oh, have a read of this.
I find this really fascinating because the diary represents a continuity in the sense that it's you, you know, through time. But you mentioned reinventing yourself, but that it's almost as though, and this is me speaking as someone who keeps a diary, it's as though that there's a common core in terms of who you are. Obviously, we change through time, but a sense of, you know, as you said, you're looking back on what you were doing 1 year ago, 2 years ago, etc. But the way that you may present yourself to other people may not be, you know, or there may not be all of the facets on display that the diary is going to consist of. And yet I'm guessing that there may be things that with one particular audience, you know, one or person you may not reveal, but that in another context, maybe a few years down the line, that might be something that could come up. So is there that sense of, though, almost like trying to find what works? Well, to an extent, maybe for the other person, in terms of, we all do that. I mean, you know, sometimes depending on, you know, if you're with your students or with colleagues, or depending on the age of the people, or, you know, or the prejudices of the people, you know, you're very conscious of how much about yourself that you divulge. Mm-hmm. But it's always interesting, isn't it, how sometimes we always have to play this game. And job interviews can be one obvious example where you kind of know the things that should be said and the things that shouldn't be said. But, you know, that they may not necessarily be representative of the whole ethos of the person that you are. So do you find those sort of almost like a regular kind of, is it like a particular challenge, or is it just something very strategic in that you can manage it?
I mean, it is, because I think, you know, when you're part of the LGBT community, you are constantly required to, I wouldn't say reinvent yourself, but to, you're constantly required to negotiate, you know, the timings of, you know, if you start a new job, when do you out yourself to your colleagues? Do you wait until somebody asks about your husband and then quietly and or sort of politely correct them? And I have to say, it's easier for me personally, it's easier now, because, and I think that's related to age, because as you get older, you give less of a monkey's about other people's reactions, but also because I feel that that we have to represent each other. But it is a constant need to negotiate your sexuality in relation to the world, and also to, by reinventing, like I said, I've moved around a lot, I've moved jobs a lot, so you are constantly having that negotiation with the world and the people around you. And I think my tendency to reinvent myself, I always feel like I'm starting again, and that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing from my point of view, because I can shed the things that I don't want to carry with me, emotionally, physically, and be the person that I want to be in any sort of new environment. But you do have to negotiate. There's the constant things that people carry with them. For me, of course, one of them is being gay. So that's something that I can't change, and I wouldn't change. But you do have to just, you know, you don't walk into a job on your first day, do you, and say, and by the way, before you all start, this is my life. Yeah. That's not how it works. So there is, it's always, and you know, obviously lots of LGBT people say the same thing, because we all have to do that. It's not, we're living in a straight world. So.
And I'm wondering if that's why you started a diary, because it sounds as though you mentioned there are certain things that maybe growing up, family, that you couldn't talk about. But it sounds as though maybe the diary became a way of expressing, assuming that is, that you were aware when you were younger, or you were able to articulate when you were younger what you've just articulated now. And it must be fascinating to go back to those diaries, I'm guessing, and kind of see whether there were some things that you just couldn't talk about back then, and the strategies that you had to put in place in order to ensure that you were, quote, socially acceptable.
It's interesting, because the diaries that I have are not from my childhood. I did keep a diary when I was a child, but I don't have those anymore. No. Again, that's part of my sort of letting go of an old life, I think, and moving on. I wasn't aware when I was a child. I think I said in my Pride Month piece, you know, I grew up straight in a straight world. It wasn't anything. Questioning was not something that we did. I look back now and think, well, I found those early relationships with boys quite strained and difficult to navigate, and I found the male-female power hierarchy completely insane. I just was horrified that, you know, that I would have to be in any way subservient to somebody just on the base of sex. That's crackers. That was always crackers, and that's probably something I was taught in the family as I grew up. But so I found those difficult, but you just get on with it, because you just assume that everybody's having the same kind of time. And it wasn't until I was at university and that I was able to meet different people in different environments. And then, of course, I met my current partner, now wife, back in 1985, but we haven't been together that long. we met and for me, the world changed. And when people say, "Oh, love at first sight," I've always kind of like, "Oh God, please." But actually, I look back at that moment and I think, yes, that for me was something changed for me that was never going to change back. And we didn't get together until many, many years later. It's been sort of a journey of twists and turns, really, but we got to the right result in the end.
I think that that is a beautiful story, because so many people, and myself included, have gone back to sort of university days with the whole what if you've been in a difficult relationship or marriage. It's very easy, and this probably is also why the nostalgia podcast was born, that sense of going back almost to the starting point. Thought, I was happy then, they were good people. Those conversations, and often it's those informal conversations when you don't quite know what the future has in store and you're struggling a bit and trying to work out your path in life. And I've often been taken back, the things that I remember. It's not the big events, not the big, like the graduation ceremonies or the official or the big holidays that you have. It's sitting in somebody's kitchen or a student union bar and having a pint or a coffee with somebody, chewing the cud, talking about just things that you feel comfortable talking about, a film that you've seen or a gig that you've gone to. And then 30 years on, those conversations are the ones that you remember most. And of course, it can be painful then when you then realise that obviously those connections that maybe you didn't forge at the time, it might be too late to do so now. But also, how would the other person feel if suddenly they discover that actually, you fancied them like mad 30 years ago, but you didn't tell them? And they might be like, oh, I didn't know that, and that could be overwhelming. But it sounds like in your case, you actually did achieve that sort of that goal, the circle has been squared.
I think if a lot of scientific people will say that it's a chemical reaction, isn't it, between people, and I suppose other people would say it's an energy reaction between two people. And I think, yeah, whatever, I'll take both of those. But for me, we had a brief fling, I suppose you would probably call it now. And then, she wasn't at university, so it was on one of my visits back to Bradford. And then, of course, there was this long period where we were sort of together and then sort of not. And, it was quite rocky. And then we had 10 years when we didn't see each other, didn't communicate, nothing at all, and met quite by chance 10 years after that. And of course, then things began to settle down somewhat. It's much more complicated than I'm making it sound.
But you talk about all of this in the sense of how you met, because I think 1985 and what the world looked. I mean, I was 12 in 1985, but it does feel. I remember the dynamics at school. I was in secondary school then, and the rules and the sort of the way that people were treated and the way that in anybody who didn't conform. I mean, even in a school sense, it was, you have to walk on the left side of the stairs to go up. And if you were walking, veering to the right of the staircase, you were told off or would get a demerit. And you just look down and think, obviously I teach university students rather than school children, but I would never treat anybody along those lines. And school never felt as though it was about education. It felt about conformity, being a good citizen. But so going back to 1985, you must sometimes pinch yourself and just think, how did you get from there to here?
Well, I think sort of nonconformity was kind of coming along. It was under development. Yeah. And it, like I said, it was a journey of twists and turns. And both of us have had relationships with other people in between then and when we eventually saw sense and got together in 2002. But we do talk about it because it is, we will say to each other, oh gosh, remember when I said this or they said that to me and then I thought it was this and it turned out to be. And actually the gay community at the time was really, really complicated. I'm sure it's just as complicated now. But there were so many, I'm not going to talk about men because I don't know, but there were so many straight women who were experimenting with this gay world that they were allowed to enter into, and then just quietly and safely go back to their sort of nice, straight, comfortable world. And it's one of those things that absolutely drove me round the bend at the time, because there's a perception that gay women can be, you know, you can just get into a relationship with them and you can, you know, have some fun, and then you can just say, oh, you know, this is not really for me, so bye. And as if there are no emotions coming back the other way. And I know some people who have really, really been hurt in processes like that. And it used to infuriate me. So for me, it wasn't just about, given that I was at university and sort of becoming more politically aware, it was never just about, oh, this is my true sexuality, this is the person that I am on the inside, this now makes sense to me, I can navigate the world with this. It was also about, you know, there's something really wrong here, because there's discrimination and there's violence against LGBT people. We didn't say LGBT back then, but and of course the AIDS pandemic was also living amongst us, and, you know, and I lost friends to that. But so the discrimination was absolutely, you know, it's everywhere. It was in government adverts, for goodness sake. And it gave people permission to, in a similar way that Brexit gave permission for people to be racist from anybody who they didn't see as white British, it gave people permission to be violent against LGBT people. And it was a very dangerous time to be in the gay community. But the way that we all survived was to come together and be political and to be activists and to shout about Section 28. Yeah. If you don't know what that is, look it up. And to demand equality from the government, and to show strength in numbers and say, we are here and we're not going away. And those were the days when, you know, people had it on their t-shirts, we're here, we're queer, and we're not going away. I suppose people still do. Some people have probably still got those t-shirts from 30 years ago. But I think that was part of, for me, the political side of being in the gay community was just as important as navigating my way through the emotional relationships and trying to make good choices about who you wanted to spend at least a number of years with. So I was sort of, you know, for want of a better term, serial monogamist, I suppose. And I think that, again, you know, every relationship was the beginning of something new, and it was exciting, and it was meaningful, and I put my heart and soul into it. But if I'm honest, and I hope none of my ex-partners have heard this, but if I'm honest, I think there was always in the back of my mind, subconsciously, I think, that there was this person that I had met in 1985, and that was going to be my forever relationship. And that sounds terrible to say that I, you know, I was always thinking about, you know, I always had one door on the one hand on the door handle, but there was, if I'm honest with myself, I think there was that feeling of impermanence that now doesn't stalk my days. Yeah. Yeah. Because I think, you know, once Debs and I got together finally, I think I knew then that this is the rest of my life, and this is the person that I've waited for and looked for.
Yeah, that is so overwhelmingly inspiring, because that, you've got the idea of somebody and the real person. And I've done this. I've put people on pedestals. And then you realise that what you're doing is putting them on a pedestal because maybe It's like, well, I suppose like with nostalgia generally, it's a case of sometimes there's something missing in the present that causes you to go back and try to sort of, you know, find those synergies, or to try and, you know, join the dots, find that completion. And it's really interesting. It's like Beatrice and Dante's Inferno, I suppose. They do, you know, the perfect, the sort of the soulmate. But sometimes, of course, it's like, you know, the old adage about meeting your heroes. Sometimes, you know, you might have, it might be a film star or a pop star, and you meet them and you think, oh, they're not quite who I expected them to be, and you're disappointed. But with relationships, I think you're right. I mean, there are people who entered my world 30 years ago, and in some cases I'm in contact with them now through things like Facebook. But what's extraordinary is that they have an aura about them, and some people have this, and that aura... And I was thinking, you know, does it work both ways? You know, if you feel that this person, you know, encapsulates everything you could possibly want, you know, and you have to be careful where you tread, because they, you know, 30 years on, they may be in relationships, they may be in very stable, very happy relationships, and they may not think the same way about you as you think about them. But it's interesting what you said about the 80s. I remember this fear of the other. And I was, interestingly, until recently, he was the leader of, or the Speaker of the House of Lords, Norman Fowler, who left... I think he was health secretary at the time of the AIDS pandemic, and he said that, you know, Margaret Thatcher simply thought that if in the advertising they were to tell people to use protection or to be very careful, that actually the fact that they were even talking about sex would make people, you know, the gay community more promiscuous. So this sort of assumption that somehow you talk about sex and therefore they'd want to go and experiment. And it's interesting that now he's left politics in order to support the LGBT community. And that's something that, and he was somebody who was a very pivotal figure in Margaret Thatcher's administration. So I think that sort of reflection and that awareness of the changing currents of time, I think is really elucidating.
Mm. I mean, you know, they literally tried to drive us underground. Yeah. Yeah. And I think in some respects they were quite successful, you know, whatever you think about Thatcher, and God, we hated her. But she managed to drive through policy in the most brutal way, you know, really extreme things. And I think that for me, what was the most important outcome for the LGBT community was that we realised... Well, I was going to say we realised we were a community. I think the community always realised it was a community from, you know, from Stonewall, the Stonewall riots, and that coming together that actually we are a force to be reckoned with. You know, we're not going to take to the streets with sticks, although, you know, that has happened. But politically, we are a force to be reckoned with, and economically, we're a force to be reckoned with. And we will not be driven underground. I mean, I think many people were driven underground, and many people have, you know, people in my family, extended family amongst them, have not admitted their sexuality, because it just, you know, to get on in careers and to navigate the world, it was not permitted.
And do you find that is still very much the case? I mean, in your case with family, for example, I mean, was there ever an acceptance, you know, or did you just say, there's no point even trying to make this work? I mean, did you ever, you know, so on the one hand, you were trying to fight for a particular cause, but often, and how ironic, and it works in many contexts, other contexts as well, that the people that your family, the people who you're closest to, in some cases, are the least or the most impervious to change. And that must be really difficult, that you're fighting a cause and in some cases winning the battles, but there are other members who are close to you, biologically at any rate, who don't share those same values, mm-hmm. or don't accept the path that you're on. And that must be so difficult.
Yeah, and I didn't... My father was really supportive when I came out to my folks. And, I, you know, I was living 200 miles away, so, you know, I could swing in and out and swing out. And actually, you know, I look back at it and I think I didn't have to tell them at all. And I'd like to think... At the time, I thought I was doing it because, you know, you should be just honest with your parents. But actually, I knew that I was sort of throwing an incendiary device into, you know, to kind of deal with that, because I was quite, you know, I was quite quite an angry person at the time, just because of the, in terms of the social injustice around me. So I wanted to just say, you know, this is me, this is my life, deal with it, or don't, it's up to you. My mother and I didn't speak for 2 years after that. She'll tell a different story now, but she didn't react very well. And I always find it fascinating that mothers particularly feel that they would know. If you're gay, they would have always known. They'd have seen it in you when you were growing up, when literally they haven't met a gay person in their entire lives. Well, how would you know? How would you know what those traits are? But it's that sort of stereotype of, oh, I know how gay people behave, and therefore I would have recognised it in you. And so that was a really difficult time. I absolutely understand, and it's tragic, but it is still the truth, that I understand why young people, first of all, find it difficult to come out to their families, or indeed hide it from their families, and in some instances lose all contact with their families. And saying to people, you know, you create your own family because you have to, is not really a comfort when, you know, in the society we live in, we're told that family is so important. And actually, you know, most of us at least want to get along with our families. I don't think there are many people who just go, right, well, thanks for bringing me up, but bye. And I really do understand why young people still today are struggling in those situations, and lose contact with their family. There's a brilliant documentary called Pride is Protest, and it's only very short, and it opens with a journalist speaking to somebody on the street, and it was done for the 50 year anniversary of the Stonewall riots, and the respondent just saying, well, you know, I'm sorry, but if I found out that any of my children were gay, that would be it. They'd be gone. They would be dead. And you hear that so often, don't you? And it's saddening, isn't it, that, you know, in today's world where we have so much access to information, and we can, if we choose to, we can learn about so many things about other people that are so different to us and have different lives to us. It's so sad that we still have that feeling that that your family are the people that are most likely to reject you, and that's an unhappy and awkward truth of the human species, I think.
Yeah, and I witnessed that at university, and people who some people very close to me who were unable to come out and be the person they are now. And I mentioned before we started, somebody I was in a relationship with who is now the author of lesbian fiction. And I haven't, you know, I have had a little bit of contact with her in recent years when she had a book published. But I'd love to know exactly what her family thought of, you know, I mean, were they perhaps surprised? Were they not surprised? You know, she was always worried about how they might react. But maybe it didn't go as badly as she thought it would. So all these, you know, all these years of living in denial, or having books sent in the post in brown envelopes, you know, so that the parents wouldn't see in the top left-hand corner, you know, something that says, you know, Stonewall or something, I don't know, or something that would suggest that they might be reading something that is, you know, quote off limits. I find that deeply interesting. And also to see where the students of today are, who, when I have these conversations, don't see it as being a problem in anything like the same kind of way for their generation, and they're very accepting. I do find that in lots of ways with disability issues as well. You know, when I was at school in the 80s, if you were perceived to be a bit different, a bit eccentric, then they would laugh at you, in some cases throw stones at you, or, you know, just sort of ridicule you. I see students now very sensitive to the behaviour of other students and disabled students, for example, which is amazing. You know, compared to what I remember witnessing back in the 80s, when, as you say, if you were gay in the 80s at school, everyone would just laugh at you, or, you know, you'd be a figure of, you know, the fear of the other, I think, would land on you. So, of course, you'd hide all of that. It's just interesting to see how in the course of a generation or two, there have been some quite marked shifts.
I mean, I agree I partly agree, but what I would say is that that may just be the students that you come across. Because there certainly is still a lot of intolerance against LGBT people. And also we know, and there have been instances here, where there is a lot of discrimination by young people against young people of colour. And so I think there is an expectation. I think the expectation to behave reasonably and decently and respectfully, so, you know, Kent Union's Expect Respect campaign, I think the expectation is much louder. And hopefully institutions and organisations' tolerance for discrimination is now lower, that, you know, we are much more likely to take action against people who are deemed to be acting, you know, either racist or homophobic or transphobic or, you know, or whatever else it is. But it's absolutely still there. And I think we'll often hear that, you know, well, you've got equality now, so what are you all still shouting about? And actually, we're still shouting because if you think the LGBT community, if anybody thinks the LGBT community has got equality, then they're misunderstanding what equality really is about. And add that to people with disabilities.
Yeah.
Add that to people of colour. Add that to people of different ages, even. You know, the discrimination is almost it's a human trait that I don't think is ever going. Well, it's not going away very quickly.
No, actually, that's a really good corrective, because you're right. Because the students I teach may not be representative in the same way with Brexit. Everybody I knew here on campus was going to vote in a particular way. You know, was going to vote to stay in the EU, and then when the result came through, even in Canterbury, and you discovered that, you know, more than 50% voted against, you think, oh, but everyone I've spoken to voted against Brexit, and yet. Then I don't obviously know the other people, the other 50% who did. So that is also a bit of an awakening when you realise that you are in a bit of an ivory tower, and that when you're in a class of very reasonable and very sensitive and very inclusive students, you realise that actually that's very good and very heartening, but actually they're not necessarily representative of everybody of their age group everywhere in the whole country, the whole world.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, you need those times when you're in groups where everybody, I won't say thinks the same, but is sort of on the same political spectrum, because that's the thing that feeds your soul, I think, and reminds you that, you know, you're not an outsider or you know, a lone wolf, that there are people who think and feel the same way that you do. And, you know, straight allies are so important to our community, because so very many people want to support the LGBT community, and some want to and don't know how to, but you know, it is also a brave thing, I think, for straight people to step forward and say, no, actually, this is not acceptable. You know, we have to support minoritized groups. And I think that we need to see the commonalities between minoritized groups, because, you know, Brexit is just indicative to me of the rise of the far right that's happening, and that danger that presents to, you know, when we look back at what happened to the Jewish community during the Second World War, it also happened to LGBT people, also happened to people with disabilities. And I think that what we need to make sure of is that when we all support each other as minoritized groups, we are a much stronger force, and only that, I think, can suppress that rise of the far right that's so prevalent at the moment. You know, Brexit was a really, and continues to be, I think, a really worrying time, because not because of, you know, whether we can get food across the channel or not, but human rights, I think, is in danger, and that sort of gentle whittling away of people's ability to have the rights that they're entitled to, and that prevalence, that sort of re-emergence of people as the other, that's always been there. But I think it has made it possible for some folk to be more vocal about othering people that they see as different to themselves.
It's like the maxim, you know, for every action there's an equal and positive reaction, or opposite reaction. And it feels that that's happening here, that at a time when, you know, there's an inexorable case for civil rights, for gay rights, for, you know, inclusivity and equality and diversity. And yet then you come across, and we have it now with that new TV channel, is it GB News, or, you know, or with Brexit, you kind of feel that they're very loud. But there's also, I think the reason they're so loud is because they are the in the vanguard, that they're representing the opposition that's inevitable. But also that the opposition, as with Brexit, you know, there will come a point in future generations, you know, when the people who, you know, the older people who perhaps significantly voted for Brexit are no longer with us. And I think time will tell. And I think we will find in generations to come that there will be a sort of, you know, what was the fuss all about? I hope that's the case. But that can't disguise the fact that at the moment it's very brutal, and that people are being traumatised by the fact that, you know, I've got colleagues here who have now had to take British citizenship tests in order to stay in the country because, you know, they came here as Europeans studying in a European university, and then realised that because of Brexit they have to almost like question their identity. Mm. You know, they were Europeans and everyone was happy with that, but now that's not really applicable anymore because Brexit has turned back the tide. So it does kind of feel that sometimes for every step forward there's always a couple of steps backwards.
And actually, if we British folk were to take those tests, we'd probably all get chucked out, wouldn't we? Because we would probably fail.
Isn't that I find that with football, actually. I mean, I don't follow football at all, but it's amazing that England got to the final of a major championship. But then what was the news was all about? It was about racism. It's like, how dare, you know, on the one hand, I felt a certain pride in the country. I don't follow, I'm Welsh, actually, but, you know, I don't follow football. But I was excited, you know, for the match. Although, at the same time, I've got lots of Italian friends. So I was like, you know, I really don't mind who wins, but excited that, you know, that a lot of people were sort of very galvanised. At a time of the pandemic as well, we all needed something to sort of get us excited about. And then you then see this dreadful, you know, reaction against some of the players. Because what they did was completely set back the good civil relations. Also, you know, it's that almost that idea that some people think that they have a sense of what, you know, a British identity is. And it becomes about otherness and about whiteness. It's like, well, how dare they determine what actually constitutes Britishness? And I guess I'm in an interesting position because I sound English, but I'm Welsh. I don't follow football at all. I really don't care for it. But very supportive of the people who are. And I utterly get that because I have my own, you know, I'll say, well, I watch the Oscars or something. You know, those people are like, why would you do that? I say, but you'd watch the football if it was on overnight. Oh, that's different. Why is it different? You know, so I'm used to all those sort of conversations.
And I think as soon as those penalties were taken, as soon as they were taken, Debs and I turned to each other and said, the racist abuse is going to be horrendous tomorrow. Yeah. Well, from now. And unfortunately, that did come to pass. But just going back to what you were saying about sort of mainstream media, it makes me think about representation. It's really, one of the things I think is really important is that we see more people of colour, more people with disabilities, more people from LGBT community in mainstream media. I'm sort of more radio person, but I know Chichi Nwaneku was doing a show on Classic FM about composers and musicians from a BAME background, and I hate to use that acronym, but Black and Asian Minority Ethnic background. And I remember sort of saying, when are they going to have somebody on that's going to do an LGBT version? And of course, then they did. So I was very happy about that. I think that that's really important, and not just in a sort of very caricature way, which it has been in the past. You know, we've had sort of, you know, the Danny LaRue's of the world, and the I can't remember his name, but sort of very extreme, sort of gay caricatures almost on the stage.
Well, Larry Grayson, for example.
Larry Grayson is exactly who I was thinking of. But I think that it's important that people are brave enough to be out and to be in the public eye and doing normal, in parentheses, stuff, not just being there because, you know, you're the only gay in the village or whatever it happens to be. Yeah. Oh, quick, let's get a gay person. We must have one of those. And it becomes normalised so that this fear and, you know, phobia, homophobia. I remember having this conversation with Debs a few weeks ago. Is it phobia? What are people afraid of? They're not afraid of something. You know, you have phobia about spiders or fresh air or, you know, whatever people have phobias about. But actually, most people who fear gay people have probably never met any and are afraid of the stereotype, what they think of as, you know, gay people out there in the world. And we just need to get over that, really, and portray all people as just people. I think the community of disabled people also has that challenge of, you know, that normalisation and not being forever, we must make allowances because they're not like us.
Yeah.
Yeah. and it is a form of othering, even though people are trying to be generous about it.
And that's the irony, isn't it? Because so many people, you know, we talk about disability, but it depends how you define disability. Because you know, when I was at school, anybody who was dyslexic, and there weren't many, or I'll rephrase that, there weren't many people who were diagnosed as dyslexic. It's completely different. You know, and if you were dyslexic, I remember a friend of mine was distraught because his sister was dyslexic, and he thought, oh, she, you know, her future's ruined. You know, she's not going to possibly go to university, etc. And it's just really interesting that now we wouldn't bat an eyelid in the sense if a student, you know, is dyslexic, well, we have a support mechanism, we can ensure that they flourish, and it's not an issue in that sense. We're going to do everything we can to support them. They're not going to not get a degree.
Brings me back to where we started, because what we've done with people who are dyslexic, people who have autism, people who have disabilities, is we have adapted our environments to accommodate, and yet with student success, when we're talking about students of colour, we still are expecting them to adapt to the organisation rather than adapting the organisation. We now know we have made progress, so we now know it is the organisation that needs to adapt, but it is challenging, I think, for organisations to adapt in that respect. Whereas I think it is easier for organisations to say, oh yes, we can build a this, or we can create a system that, or we can have people that work alongside people. But I think it is more difficult when we're saying, yes, but your black students are still being disadvantaged by the system.
Yeah.
You need to change the system. I think that's a much more difficult area for organisations to broach.
Yeah. And I've got one more question for you, which is the question I always ask everyone at the end. Are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I'm definitely a looking forward. I suppose I would say I'm a sort of looking present kind of person now. I don't want to look too far forward because there might not be that many years left, but there are more years behind me than ahead of me, shall I put it that way. But yes, as I've alluded to, I tend to bag up my past and throw it into the nearest skip and leave it behind, except I always have that record in those diaries, but I don't hold on to things. I don't like to sort of refer back to things that happened in the past too much. Despite today's conversation, I'm very much I'm a planner. What are we going to do going forward? Where are we now? Are we in the right place? Are we enjoying this life? Do we need to make it better? Do we need to make improvements? How do we do that? Rather than, obviously, I've learned a lot of things from my past, but my dad got Alzheimer's when he was my age, actually, when he was 58. He was still a year older than I am now. But and I think what that taught me was that, you know, your present is really all that you have, and actually all of that stuff. He was a very safe person. He liked to keep life quite contained and quite small. I would say this is not a criticism, it's just the way that he managed his life. And I think all of my life I've used that to kick against and think, I must go and explore, I want to do different things, I want to. And then, of course, him getting Alzheimer's has such a massive impact on the family anyway. But again, I look at that and I think, you know, we must push on. We must create good things for ourselves and things that we feel that we are proud of and that we can look back on, you know, in years to come and think, yeah, you know, I don't have any regrets about that. So it's just creating that life well lived, I think.
Yeah, that is the most, you know, wonderful and actually, if I may say, very inspirational. You know, there are so many things that you've said. Oh yeah, absolutely. In what you just said, Jan, thanks so much for being my guest this week.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thanks for asking me.